You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Have you ever had emotions so strong that you've been afraid to actually feel them? Do you ever feel completely lost when your therapist or coach asks you to sit and be with your emotions? Do you ever wonder how to bridge the gap between mind and body so that you can feel emotions instead of turning to behaviors? Well, in this episode, I dive deep into these questions with Rahel Heineman, another recovery podcast and therapist who specializes in eating disorders. If you've ever struggled with feeling your emotions and sitting with your urges, this is the episode for you. I hope you enjoy this episode of the show. Hello, Rahel. How are you today?
I am so good, and it's great to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's so great to speak to a fellow podcaster.
Oh, it's definitely a rarity. I celebrate this. This is my fun. We're going to party today. It's a very strange way that we podcasters party.
Podcast party up in here. Yes. Oh, man. What do you love about podcasting? Like, what's your favorite part about podcasting?
Oh my God, there are so many, but I think one of my favorite is meeting new people. I don't only do guest interviews, but they're sort of my highlight because I get to meet people. It gives me an excuse to meet people that I wouldn't necessarily be like, oh, hi, you want to hang out? But if you want to come on my podcast, that's an excuse. And I have so many wonderful friends from the last couple of years. I love socializing. I love people. So that's definitely been a highlight.
I feel the same way. I love that the podcast is a great reason to just meet people. It's like a ticket to talk to so many amazing humans in the field. And it's not just an awkward networking conversation. It's a deep conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. And you get the forum to really connect as opposed to like this awkward coffee, well, now Zoom date. Like, okay, well, what do we say now?
Zoom dates are a little tough, especially when you're both trying to network. It's like, okay. Anyway, what is your favorite part about working with people who have eating disorders?
This is a good question. I really like a lot of different parts. Just because as a therapist, I really derive so much meaning from my work and working with people and seeing the transformation. But I think specifically with people with eating disorders, there are so many different experiences that people have with eating disorders. We say, oh, an eating disorder. But there are as many individuals, there are that many differentiations or whatever the word is, of different iterations of an eating disorder. And so seeing how each person is so individual, even if they sort of, quote, meet criteria of the same thing as the next person, has been so wildly fascinating to me, and trying to understand the bigger picture with all these people, getting to know them and not just their eating disorder and let's change your behaviors and things like that. It's so funny. When I would ride the subway in New York City, I used to play this game with my family and my friends of like, what do you think that person's life is like? And I feel like as a therapist, I actually get to do that, not in a nosy way, but like, not just what do you look like and what bag are you wearing, but who are you and what's underneath? And I think that that's so fascinating. And I really deeply appreciate the clients that I work with and their vulnerability with me. It's so rewarding.
I love that so much. It's like that subway game you played. I'm sure I've done that in my life too. Like, we are people. So yeah, I think the beautiful part, and I love that you say this, is really seeing the whole person and seeing the variation of that. Like, some folks have the same diagnosis, but it manifests its way in so many different ways. And the roots of the disorder and the intentions of the disorder are all different. And that is pretty fascinating. So I love how you shed light on that. I think that is so true.
Yeah, I really love it. It's amazing.
Amazing. Well, on that note, today we're actually talking about our eating disorder behaviors and how they are protective, and essentially how these behaviors are rooted within our lives and how they're associated with painful emotional experiences. And because you're a therapist, I think you're the perfect person to talk about this with, because all the emotional deep stuff, as a coach, I don't always go to the deep, deep stuff, but as a therapist, I know this is like your zone of expertise. So to just dive into that, when you say that eating disorder behaviors or symptoms are actually protective, what do you mean? Because I'm guessing some people are like, no, they're not. They're harmful. Like, what does she mean by this? So where does that come from?
There's definitely a lot of pushback. When you think about that statement, it does seem false, because the whole point of why somebody is listening to this podcast or going to therapy is because the eating disorder has become incredibly harmful, or at least really disruptive in their life. And so saying that it's protective or serves a function is really hard to wrap your head around. But I think in this case, it's not an either or, it's an and. So eating disorders, especially in their development, for sure in their maintenance as well, you know, let's focus on the development of an eating disorder, is for a very specific purpose. And maybe not to be too reductionist as one purpose, but it serves a function, and that is to protect us. And at this point, it's gotten way out of hand, so it's also its own problem, but we sort of have both of them at the same time. And I think the trap that a lot of people fall into is when they focus only on that the eating disorder is a problem, then we can't zoom out and really appreciate why the eating disorder is there in order to actually work through it, ultimately get past it. So we do have to see it as both in order to really get at the roots, if you will.
Yeah, that is very true. It's like, as they say in the field, eating disorders are rooted in wisdom. Like, we kind of took on these behaviors to function better in the situation we were in, or survive the situation we were in. And so I think when you do kind of respect maybe your younger self for trying their best to survive a situation, you know, we can't shame ourselves for that, even though now the eating disorder has turned into something harmful. Like, in the past, you know, it was a way for your younger self to do the best they can.
Yes. And I'll add to that is that maybe in a way that sounds kind of twisted, right now it is still serving a purpose and a function. And what we call the maintenance of eating disorder is not just the development of it. So at this point, it's really tricky because it is currently both.
Got it. Yeah, that's a really important distinction to make. So could you explain maybe some of these functions, that like a few examples of what functions people use eating disorders to carry out, just so people can get a sense of what we mean?
Yeah. So maybe before I give an example, I'll give you my general understanding of the function of an eating disorder. I think that having worked with so many people and so many different variations of eating disorders, this is something that is across the board. And I've never met anybody that this doesn't apply to. So what I've learned is that eating disorders, and I guess to a certain extent, a lot of mental health, or maybe all of mental health challenges, but we're talking specifically about eating disorders, is a way to regulate emotion. And when emotion, meaning all of them, feel too big to tolerate, we don't really know what to do with them, they just feel so massive, eating disorders come in. This is not exactly like a conscious process. Let me whip out my restriction and be able to tolerate what's going on. But this is happening under the surface. So it's a way to regulate all of that emotion that feels really, really big. And so for some people, it might be again, all of the emotions. For some people, it might be very specific ones that are really hard to tolerate. But the eating disorder really is the means to regulate. And that ultimately is super, super reductionist, not at all giving enough credit to the complexity of eating disorders. Just because we're talking about this narrow perspective, eating disorders serves as a way to protect ourselves from what we perceive the emotions to do to us.
So helpful to think of it in that light. And it is a compassionate way to think of that. I know when I was going through my eating disorder, I had a really hard time dealing with the negative emotions. I always felt like I had to be really happy. And so I didn't know what to do with the quote unquote negative emotions, because not all emotions are bad, right? It's like the ones that, like things like anger and guilt and shame and rage, those are the ones I had no tools to cope with. Right. I kind of had disowned those in my life. And then I think that helped develop the eating disorder and the use of the behaviors in my life.
Exactly. Well, and then also you think about, what about these emotions do I think that I shouldn't be feeling them? You know, it's, again, it's not a conscious process, but how did it come to be that this is the case, that I only have to be positive and happy all the time? And I think that, you know, just to take a step back in terms of like bad or good emotions, all emotions are absolutely necessary for us to function in this world. They're almost like this rule book or guide, rather, not a rule book, guide for us to be able to be flexible in how we're experiencing the world and interacting with the world and the people around us. So for example, if you think about the feeling or the emotion of guilt, it lets us know, okay, I'm not very happy about how I feel about what just happened. Maybe I need to go apologize to someone and make amends. Maybe I need to change how I'm doing something in the future. If I feel really angry, maybe there is a way in which I did not assert my boundaries and someone violated that. Maybe there's someone who's taking advantage of me and I need to, you know, make some space for myself. Maybe there are ways that I'm not expressing myself and I need to say more. So this is all really valuable information. And if we push those away and say those are bad, then we don't get the valuable information that's really necessary from these, I guess, more on the uncomfortable side of the emotions. So I think it's really important to think about emotions in general as information, as opposed to bad and good.
Oh, 100%. I'm right there with you. I feel like emotions are all beautiful to an extent because they are pointing us somewhere, or they're trying to teach us something about how we feel, or, you know, what's happening to us in that situation. And I know you like to say that emotions have messages for us, right? They can be decoded in a way. And so how can we begin to decode these messages that our emotions are sending, and sometimes via behaviors and urges?
Yeah, well, I think, so even just to decode the answer to this question, is there's a lot in here, because I think for the most part, especially with people who are struggling with an eating disorder, they're not entirely connected with their emotional experience. Now, probably very intimately connected with shame, especially around body image, and guilt, perhaps around binges. But in terms of the extensive emotional experience with interpersonal interactions and other experiences, it's usually the case that people aren't intimately connected with their emotions. And I think that we can't possibly understand what's going on if we don't really even know how to identify it. So I think going back to the eating disorder is one really great clue, is to see what are the things I'm feeling about my behaviors or about my body. And that's a really big key to see what are the things that I should probably look at a little bit more. So for example, you know, if somebody's having a terrible body image day and there's so much shame involved, well, let's look at that. Let's look at, what does this shame feel like in your body? Do you notice anything in your body? Do a head-to-toe scan through your entire body. Identify, start putting words to it. What is making you feel shame? What are the thoughts attached to shame? And really the first step before we go any further is just identifying. Because otherwise, we just get caught up in this and we jump way too far ahead. We're like, okay, well, how do we deal with this? How do we get rid of it? But we don't even know what we're dealing with. So that's if we know the emotion, even if it's just attached to behaviors and not other things, that's where we can start with something like that.
I absolutely love that. I think that is such a great trick for people who are not connected with their emotions at all at that point. You know, sometimes people have completely disowned their emotions outside of their eating disorder. So why not use the eating disorder to gain some emotional literacy around like your experiences? So I think that's such a great little first step, like a starting path. And I love how you emphasize the importance of identification, because honestly, identification is so helpful moving beyond too. Like, okay, so I know how shame feels in my body with body image. I know that when I feel shame for, and I'm making stuff up right now, but like when I feel shame, I feel a heaviness in my body. My thoughts feel this way. You know, I don't know, my chest feels tight. Like when I feel shame, this is what I'm experiencing with body image. You can start noticing shame in other areas of your life too, which I think could manifest similar experiences in the body.
Exactly. And I think ultimately, when we think about how eating disorders might be directly connected with our thoughts and feelings outside of the eating disorder, is that perhaps, I don't mean to suggest that the shame attached to body image is not shame attached to body image, because obviously it is, like it's there, but it's also about some other things. And I think that, you know, I don't want people to jump into this, you know, in the beginning stages of their recovery and be like, it's about other things. Well, let's first like address behaviors and try to calm us down and see if we can not be so reactive to the shame, but also at the same time, or eventually, we can try to understand how the shame attached to something so intimately connected with eating disorder related behaviors and thoughts and feelings might actually be representative of some other things, like what happened earlier in the day or last week. Who did you talk to? Who did you not talk to? What happened at work, at school? And putting some pieces together, I bet you there's some shame, like lots of it. And we just have to put some puzzle pieces together.
Yeah, I hear that. Sometimes I feel like the body image is the most accessible kind of scapegoat for shame. Like if you're collecting shameful experiences throughout the day, it's so much, for some reason, easier to channel that shame towards the body, right? Instead of putting it into that context.
Yeah. And, you know, to a lot of people's credit, it's not exactly something that we're particularly aware of. So if, say, somebody's at work and there's a meeting and someone says something that contradicts their proposal and they just sort of gloss over it, they might not even realize that what they were experiencing in that moment was shame, because it's so easy to gloss over. And so I don't think it's very simple as like, oh, just think about what happened earlier today and match it up with the shame. I guess what I mean to say is that there has to be shame buried in there somewhere. And we just have to see what about our experiences made us feel shame.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess everything we say here is never as simple as it sounds or never as easy as it sounds, right? It's never that simple, right? We're talking about shame like it's so easy to identify, but it's oftentimes so difficult to even understand. I don't know if I even now have a full understanding of my own experience of shame sometimes. So it's just a continual learning process.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times, you know, because shame is one of those that are really, really difficult to experience for most people, even if we do feel something, it's probably not going to be shame. It's going to be something perhaps covering that up. So there are a variety of different ways where we cover up emotions because it feels too intolerable. We're talking about how eating disorders are that way and we're trying to decode it. But think about how often people get angry at whoever they're talking to or the situation, and really, you know, not really, they are angry. And if we dig under the surface, where did that anger come from? they're angry because they felt ashamed, called out. Perhaps they lash out. So it's really, really not that simple.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that too. So when we're talking about decoding here, could you share more about, like, perhaps if someone has an urge, how might they start to decode their emotional experience there?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one that I will asterisk here. When we think about the deeper meaning of eating disorders and its purpose and all that, it's not in lieu of dealing with behavior change, challenging ourselves to, you know, eat a full meal plan or, you know, get rid of the scale or whatever it is that we're targeting our behaviors. So if we're thinking about, you know, what does my binge mean? Or I just felt out of control when I was eating. Well, the very, very first thing, even though we're talking about the deeper meaning, the very, very first thing is, did you have your meals and snacks? Are you restricting at all? Because we can't really cover up and say, oh, all of these behaviors have so much emotional energy involved. And then we're also restricting at the same time. So number one, let's look at that. But I guess, you know, once that's put aside, say, for example, somebody does feel like they're losing control what they're eating, even if it's not like an objective binge, it's a little irrelevant, to start thinking about when perhaps they're a little bit more calm and they can think or journal, to even just write out what happened in words so that they can see it, and then try to see if there's any point in time that they actually felt something. So I think that it's just easier to use an example of something like a binge than restrict, because restrict is a little bit more perpetual. It's not like an isolated incident, which perhaps it is, but a binge is a little bit more contained. So for example, with something like a binge, someone might feel really guilty and hopeless and angry afterward. But if you slow it down, can you put your finger on any emotions before or during? If not, that's fine. But just sort of like really slowing things down. I love journaling, and that's really a great way to slow things down, really slow things down and see, are there any emotions that you can identify? And if not, are there any physical sensations that you can identify? And that, I think, is one of the keys to start getting a little bit more in touch with your emotional experience, is to get in touch with your physical sensations.
That has always been really helpful for me too. Sometimes I feel like the physical sensations are the first clue to being able to identify an emotion, right? Mm-hmm. So when someone identifies their emotion or their physical sensations, say they've got that down, they've slowed it down, they've identified these things, what do they do with them after that?
That's a really good question. And I would say part of the issue is the question. You've probably got this question like a million times, as have I. I've probably asked this question, maybe not in this particular instance, but like, now what? Now what? Now what? And I think part of the issue when we engage in this way of thinking, okay, I did this, now what? Now what? We don't allow ourselves to sit in the discomfort and absorb the messages of what's going on. Ultimately, when we feel anything, so say, for example, guilt or whatever it is after this binge, an emotion will only last so long. There's an arc, sort of peaks at a certain point, and then it inevitably will come down every single time. The only reason why it doesn't is when people start adding all these judgments of, I shouldn't feel this way. I wish I didn't. And then, you know, sort of hopeless, I will never get out of this. And then they just sort of prolong the arc, prolong, 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 and it doesn't come down. But if we can actually sit in it and say, I feel this way, this is what my body is experiencing, I'm going to allow it to be here, and I'm not going to push it away, and I'm not even going to ask now what, I'm just going to allow it to be uncomfortable, then I think you struck gold, because that is the only thing that allows us to get through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's so helpful to think about as, okay, it doesn't feel like you're doing a lot when you pause and notice and identify, but you actually are doing something really helpful, right? So if you are a now what person, the now what is sit and feel and accept, right? And like be with it for a period of time. I find once you are with those emotions and maybe you let that kind of reach its peak, as you said, it's a lot easier to move through the urge or whatever you might be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why I love the bringing the somatic or the physical experience in, besides for that it's actually true and emotions and our physical experience are so intertwined, is that when we can bring our emotional experience or just our general discomfort to something that feels a lot more tangible, it's like, okay, this is what's happening, and this is what's happening, and this is what's happening. It's not so much like this massive, terrifying thing to feel. It's something much more tangible. In which case, when you're experiencing an urge, it's not like dealing with an unknown monster. It's, well, I guess it's dealing with the known monster, which is wildly different.
That's very interesting. Can you explain a little more about that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm thinking about my own experience of emotion. And if I were to say, oh, I'm so anxious about, I don't know, this upcoming podcast, and it's just like, who knows what's going to happen? There's so many people listening and I'm going to say the wrong thing and I'm going to sound like such an idiot and I'm going to ruin my career. And then I'm going to have to, you know, it can go all directions. But when I can sit in front of my computer and say, I am feeling anxious, my heart is racing, my hands feel clammy, my stomach is kind of in knots and my thoughts are racing. You don't scratch the thoughts, keep that aside, but just identify all the physical sensations. I sort of lean into thump, 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 clammy hands, thump, 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 thump. And it just becomes a thump, thump, thump. It doesn't mean anything. I'm not ascribing more association. And that's what escalates it.
I think that is brilliant, right? It's being with the experience and seeing it as you said, as you've told me before, allowing your feelings to actually be experiences as opposed to channeling them into symptoms or assigning meaning to what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a little bit more of a complex idea that's hard to explain in that our eating disorders are actually a communication of our pain. So if our emotions feel too big and we try to push them away, they don't actually go away as much as we'd like them to. They hang around. They hang around in our body. And then they communicate in their own way. They don't ask us. They just do it. And then for people with eating disorders, ultimately, it's a communication of all of this pain and emotional energy that they haven't communicated on their own. And so if you think about it, the only antidote is to try to get in touch with what's going on and then communicate it on your terms, which is verbal communication, as opposed to leaving that to your eating disorder and this painful communication of what's going on that is just messy and disorganized and overwhelming and chaotic.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's so important to be able to understand yourself to the point where you can see maybe something that needs to be expressed, right? Or something that needs to be communicated that hasn't. And that can be a huge part of the healing component, right? Is being able to start recognizing these emotions, maybe the roots of the emotions, so that they can be expressed. Because I think there is some healing in that and expressed in other ways outside of behaviors, obviously. So you also mentioned like when we don't feel or transform these emotions, they just get stuck inside. Can you kind of explain what happens when people continue to push away their emotions instead of feel them?
Yeah. Well, I think that's usually when our behaviors end up getting a lot worse is because there's an accumulation of all these emotions and all this pain. And well, ultimately, even in going back to the beginning of an eating disorder, like I said, the emotions don't go nowhere. And so they hang out in our body. And for some people, it's any physical symptoms, like sometimes people get headaches or get really, really tired. I don't know if people can relate to this. Like, this happens sometimes on Sundays, like Sunday night. Why do I feel so tired? Well, perhaps there's a little bit of dread of Monday, and it's like an internalization or like a somatic expression of our emotional experience. They hang around, our emotions don't go away. And if we have no capacity to express our emotions, and they feel so big to the extent that they feel completely intolerable, they're not just like uncomfortable, then our body does whatever it can to express it. And the eating disorder is a way to express the pain that somebody is in, whether it's through restricting, binging, purging, exercise, whatever it is. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse because we get more removed from our emotional experience and our understanding of the emotional experience.
Yes, I see that. And I think you're so right. As the pain escalates and gets held in, the symptoms could worsen, right? The behaviors can worsen. And so what do you have to say, like, to help the people who feel terrified to feel? Like the people who are afraid, like they have that accumulation of painful emotion hanging out in their body. And it's like a little faucet, like waiting to be tapped, right? It's like, how do you get them to start feeling if they're terrified? What do you suggest to the people who really are afraid?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a shameless plug for getting more help. You know, it's obviously not
something. I love that.
You can't really do this on your own as much as we'd love that. But I think that, you know, to answer this question, I think we have to back up a little bit and express a little bit of an appreciation mm-hmm. for how this person got to this place. And how did it come to be that emotions feel so bad that even the idea of organizing them and trying to identify them feels uncomfortable and completely impossible? I don't know for specific individuals how this happened. That's based on an individual basis. But in general, the only reason why we don't learn how to navigate emotions, because based on the messages that we've received, and a general message that a lot of people receive is don't feel that. Put that away. We don't cry here. Whatever. What is it? Big girls don't cry, or just shut it. Mom's too busy. Whatever the messages were, or we'll praise you to the nth degree if you are missed. Prim, perfect, like getting everything great at school. So there's these sort of either underhanded or implicit, explicit messages that you aren't supposed to feel. And so obviously mm-hmm. we do feel, we can't unfeel things. What kids end up learning and then we as adults end up carrying through our life is that we don't express it. And so I think, you know, just sort of like as a roundabout way to answer your question is that we have to have a deep appreciation for why we aren't doing this already. And especially if somebody has experienced significant trauma and going to a place of feeling is to put themselves back in a terrifying situation, we have to have, you know, an appreciation for that person and to really take care of that part of ourselves that will not be able to navigate this flood of emotion. And of course, we'll start small, but even just to appreciate how this happened, there's nothing wrong with you. There are so many things mm-hmm. that happened to you that made you this way. And so I think that that's, you know, hopefully a little reassuring in, you know, trying to get in touch with a little bit more of someone's emotions. And then in terms of practically what a person can do is sort of similar to what I alluded to before. And I think it does, you know, make a difference depending on who the person is. But I think very often when somebody has sort of cut themselves off of their emotional experience or their mind and body has disconnected, what we really need to do is bridge that gap because our mind is somewhere else and our body is experiencing all this pain. And that's ultimately where the identifying the physical sensations comes in, where we're almost putting ourselves in a position to relearn there is a connection between mind and body. We can put words to our body's experience and our body can tell our mind what it's experiencing. We can try to close this gap. This is not something that takes just one or two times to do. This is over time. Start to identify what's going on in your body. And over time, once we learn to do that, we establish more of a vocabulary, which we probably don't have. And then once we establish more of a vocabulary, then we can start organizing how we feel. So one way to establish more vocabulary for our emotional experience is you can use the emotion wheel, like online, you know, the emotion wheel that sort of like has like the core colors version of the core emotions.
I love the emotion. I love that wheel. I was just thinking I need to say something about the emotion wheel.
Yeah, because when you think about it, when you take an exam and you have open-ended questions, you really have to know every single answer in order to answer that question. But if you have multiple choice, you only have to recognize. So if you're not really sure what the emotion is that you're feeling, then you can look at the emotion wheel or different versions of that online, or do it with your therapist or your coach, and then you can do the multiple choice thing, which then increases your vocabulary to learn a little bit more about what's going on. After that, the trick is just to continue it, to continue to name the physical sensations, continue to identify with this new vocabulary what you're feeling. And at the same time, is also a little bit about what's scary about identifying this particular emotion, if that is what you recognized on the emotion wheel. So it's, you know, a few different prongs, and I made it sound probably too simple. It's not at all simple. And again, like, shameless plug, probably done best with somebody who is witnessing this and supporting you at the same time.
That's so helpful for the people who are afraid. And I just feel like I want to encourage the people who are afraid to know, like, there are safe ways to start this identification process, right? You can do this with a trusted professional. You can have the wheel. You can start slow, right? It might not be the floodgate experience you're anticipating, which I really think the fear sometimes comes from this fear of, once I open the door, it's all going to come rushing out. But it's not always like that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, people with eating disorders, I mean, I'm sure as your listeners know, they're very good at moderating and controlling. You know, sometimes it feels like they're very bad at it, but they're usually very good at it. And so if you think about it, start small means maybe nothing to do with your eating disorder. Maybe it starts with, on your commute to work, there's a person who's not driving normally and you're getting really frustrated. Okay, I'm really frustrated. How do I know I'm frustrated? Name the physical sensations, name, you know, that's what I mean by start small. The emotions that have less at stake.
Such a good point. I think that's really helpful because it's like practicing checking in with yourself without having to like be in the major leagues right away, right?
Yeah.
Check in with yourself around the work stuff or the friend stuff or lighter stuff before you get into the trauma stuff or the food stuff or the body stuff. So I think that's really helpful tip for people. And I know as a coach, I'm always asking people to do little emotional check-ins where they, you know, even if it's so simple as putting in a reminder on your phone twice a day to say like, okay, check in your emotions now. Look at the wheel. What emotion are you feeling at this moment? And what are you experiencing in your body in this moment? Like, what's coming up physically? And that can help people just getting maybe that neutral check-in. Like, you don't necessarily always have to check in just when you're feeling bad. You can start checking in on the good feelings too.
Exactly. And there's so much nuance in the good feelings. There's excited and joyful and giddy. There's so many different ones. So maybe, yeah, start there.
Yeah. Well, I love that. And I really appreciate you taking the time today, Rahel, to just be with this community and these listeners and share more about emotions, because I really do believe emotional work is fundamental in healing from an eating disorder. And as a coach, we're always talking about behavior change. It's, you know, there's so much action orientation in a lot of the work I do. So it's always really nice when we have more discussion around emotion, because it is just so imperative to work through during your healing process. So thank you so much for being here today. And I appreciate everything you've shared.
Yes. And thank you again for having me. This was amazing.
Amazing. And actually, before I let you go, can you share with the audience a little bit about where they can find your work if they're interested in connecting with you?
Sure. Well, everything usually lives on my website. It's rahelheineman.com. My podcast is called Understanding Disordered Eating. And I just recently released a guide to really help you get in touch with a little bit more of the deeper side of your eating disorder. It's a journal prompt exercise, so they can grab that on my website as well. And you can find me on Instagram. I'm Rahel Heineman there too.
Fabulous. I really appreciate that information. And again, thank you, Rahel. I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day.
All right, that concludes this week's episode of the Full and Thriving Podcast.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the show. When you have a moment, please head on over to Instagram and follow my recovery coaching account at Meg_McCabe to stay up to date on everything I'm doing in recovery land. And if you're feeling extra inspired, please send me a direct message to let me know how this podcast has impacted your life. I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.